Blog Talk Radio.
Big chair for 1 minute, because tonight we're airing a special encore presentation of our friend Acharya, D.M. Murdoch. She's an author, researcher, archaeologist, and ethnomythologist. And she's also a very ill person who's trying to get better right now, and that's one of the reasons we're re-airing this broadcast. So if you could stop by the show, it would be great. Read about her story. We've got a link where you can donate to the D.M. Murdoch Wellness Fund. So please stop by the show and you can find that link. And if you want to read more about our friend or check out her books and other materials, go to www.truthbetold.com. So this is a shout out from Leslie and I to D.M. Murdoch. Get better soon, and we're with you and thinking of you. And here's the show.
Alone. And a very, very good evening to everyone out there. This is your host, Leslie Mitchell-Clark, and we'd like to welcome each and every one of you to another episode of Contact. And we are live this evening, folks. I know we have had pre-recorded shows for various reasons the past couple of weeks, but we are live this evening, and as always, we're going to look for you to call in. And we're just very excited because we have a marvelous guest. This evening's guest is the brilliant and controversial author, archaeologist, and I would call her an ethnomythologist, but perhaps that's not correct. Anyway, Acharya S., otherwise known as D.M. Murdoch, is joining us this evening. And we're going to be talking about her most recent book. Actually, it's a very propitious book to be talking about because we're going to be interfacing the book subject with Easter and Passover and such. But her latest book is called Did Moses Exist? The Myth of the Israelite Lawgiver. So we're going to be talking about the relationship between Moses and Easter, and also D.M. Murdoch has recently put a new article, if you will, out on her one of her many websites, and it's called Moses, the Promised Land, and Easter. And if you want to find out a little bit more about that, you can always log on to truthbeknown.com or freethoughtnation.com or stellarpublishing.com. So as always, the phone lines are going to be open in the second half of the show. We're looking forward to speaking with you. And if you're calling in from the U.S., we do have a toll-free number for you, which is 888-391-3884. And otherwise, you can reach us by calling 424-220-1861. All right, there you go. And before we get into our conversation, I just wanted to mention our gracious sponsors very quickly. That would be origobooks.com, O-R-I-G-O, and also conspiracyculture.com, and, of course, Enchanted Reveries Jewelry, and you can reach them at www.etsy.com. And also, we would like to thank the UFOria organization, James Borg and Charlie Kundalini, and all the wonderful folks at UFOria who are our constant support. So there you go. That's the housekeeping. And I see we have a call on the line here, and I'm going to hope that it's Acharya. Let me see about that. Good evening. You're on Contact. Hello? Hello, is anyone there? Okay. I'm not sure what's happening there, but I guess they hung up momentarily. Let's try this other line here. Hello, good evening. You're on Contact. Hello? Okay, that's not working out too well there. Let's try this line here. Hello, good evening. You're on contact. Hello? Okay. Sure what's going on there. All right. Well, hopefully Achaya will be calling in very, very shortly. And once again, we're very, very happy that you've joined us this evening. As we're waiting for Achaya to call in, let me just read a little bit of a quote from some notable people discussing this matter. And actually, I have a quote from Dr. Barbara J. Siverston, from her book, The Parting of the Sea. And Dr. Siverston says, "No archaeological traces can be attributed to the early Israelites in Canaan before the early Iron Age, which, of course, is after 1200 BCE. And there is no evidence of a distinct population of early Israelites in Egypt. The area west of the Jordan River reveals an archaeological picture quite at odds with the biblical accounts of the Israelite journey to the Promised Land, and there is little or no evidence of the conquest as it is described in the book of Joshua, in the archaeological record of the late Bronze Age Canaan." So we're going to be chatting about that for sure. All righty. Let me just pick up this call here. One moment. Good evening. You're on contact.
That would be me. Hello.
That would be you. You resemble you. Thank you so much for calling in, Achaya. We're just so we're so very, very pleased that you're able to join us this evening, and especially as many cultures celebrate various versions of what I would call a sort of a vernal equinox festival. And I know we're going to get into that. I'm fascinated. I happened to read your wonderful article that you sent me earlier, Exploring Moses, the Promised Land, and Easter. And I was just reading Dr. Barbara Silverton's quote. And tell me, Archaya, what inspired you to begin thinking about the Moses persona, or the Moses myth, if you will, as a sort of an anthropomorphic mythological figure rather than perhaps a literal individual?
Well, you probably know that I've written several books on the mythology behind Christianity and the figure of Jesus. So
absolutely.
That has been quite a controversy. But over the years, and I had included Moses, of course, mentioned him several times in my previous books. And but I'd stumbled across scholarship in the last decade or so where people, like with Israel Finkelstein's Bible Unearthed,
mm-hmm.
showing that what you read earlier about the Israelite emergence is quite different from the Mosaic account.
Mm.
And so I was working on a revision of my book, The Christ Conspiracy, and it struck me that there were plenty of people saying that Moses was a fictional or mythical character, and they had no problem with that assertion. In fact, that's so mainstream, it's even mentioned on Wikipedia's article about Moses. Yeah. I mean, Wikipedia is edited by a lot of people who have biases, including especially the religious articles.
Oh, completely, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of what we call bibliolaters, which are people who idolize the Bible.
I love that. I better got to write that down immediately right now. That is so apt.
Bibliolaters. It's a great word, bibliolatry, bibliolaters. But they sit like vultures waiting for people to change these articles on Wikipedia about Christianity and or the Bible,
yeah.
And they're just like infuriated when anything remotely critical pops up. So to have even Wiki saying there's no evidence for a Moses or a conquest or Exodus or any of the stories in the Pentateuch surrounding
mm-hmm.
this figure.
Mm-hmm.
Then you know that something's awry. Of course, I knew that he's a mythical figure based on my previous analyses. And so
right.
A couple years ago, I decided, well, you know what, why don't I just take some of the literature, some of the scholarship I've already created, written, and compile it in a book. Man, that took on a life of its own. I should know better than ever to say, hey, I think I'll just, you know, put this together and put a book out. Because, I mean, as soon as I posted this news on my forum, I was bombarded by people asking me about Akhenaten and the Hyksos and Osirseph. And it just went, you know, it just went on and on and on. So I realized, well, now I have this massive project on my hands. Mm-hmm. And it took me a couple of years of intense, you know, scholarship, research, my mind in ancient texts in multiple languages and digging up everything.
Of which you speak several, I did want to point out, you're really a linguist yourself. You speak, I don't know, what six languages fluently, and including ancient Greek, and you're you know, able to negotiate in three or four more. So there's a tremendous amount of scholarship in this book, from what I perceive, that does come from an array of cultural sources. So forgive me for interrupting. So carry on. You were in the midst of your big project.
Well, I had to really knuckle down and get into the Hebrew, and it wasn't just the Hebrew. That led to the Ugaritic, which is a form of Canaanite, and then there was the Phoenician and the Babylonian and the Akkadian and the Assyrian.
Whoa.
And the Egyptian and the Eblite and the, you know, just it was huge. So the thing about this subject, people saying that Jesus Christ is a myth gets people all, you know, frazzled. But I was able to provide multiple quotes, like the one you read by Syverson, but specifically stating there's no evidence for Moses. And these are by Egyptologists and other mainstream archaeologists and anthropologists working in Israel. And they're stating this outright. This is like a matter of course now within biblical scholarship, not among the fundamentalists, obviously, but among the more skeptical scientific branch of that scholarship. And they're not flinching at this, especially the Egyptologists. They're saying, wait a second, you know, we're down now in the dirt for the last couple of centuries. We see no evidence of this. We know what this means. And so I spent the first part of the book just dissecting the tale and showing where there is no evidence for it. It doesn't make any sense. It's completely illogical. There's something like, what is it, 29 trillion quails would have been necessary to feed the Israelites. We're supposed to believe in one just ridiculous supernatural event after another in order for this to be presented as history. So the first half of my book or so is a dissection of the tale in terms of historicity and science and what the archaeology has been telling us.
Mm-hmm.
And I use pristine sources, not only modern archaeologists who are actually digging in the dirt and their opinions and their excavation reports and whatnot, but also, like you said, going back to the primary sources, and that would be mostly the Egyptian, showing biblical, showing where this cannot be so, cannot have happened in history. So then once we've dispensed with that as a historical occurrence, now we know it's a mythical tale, it's a legend, it's like the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Mahabharata, these things, they take place in real locations, but they are either mythical stories and legends, or they're heavily mythologized. But and so now we look at that and we say, well, where does it all come from? Because seldom do these things just spring out of nowhere. You know, even our modern storytelling has a great deal of previous mythology and legend woven into it.
Yeah.
And so I started looking around, and it opens up a whole can of worms. This is how I've approached my other previous efforts, like the Christ Conspiracy, where I did a similar thing with the Jesus myth. You know, the first part of it shows, look, it didn't happen in history, so what does it mean? And that's where I really like, you know, after you get rid of that annoying false historization, you can really get into the nitty-gritty of what it means, and that's where I find it all to be fascinating, because it represents a a long lineage of storytelling that could go back tens of thousands of years.
Indeed, and it doesn't make it any less spiritual. That's what I find so astounding about some of the criticism that's been heaped, your way. You know, for one thing, anybody that denies that there can be fusions of myth and magic and history, is an idiot, because there are oral traditions that, I mean, otherwise, we would not have, in our modern times, we would not have Santeria, we would not have hoodoo or voodoo, we would not have many of these fusion belief systems that are an amalgamation of ancient nature myths. And I think that people also, traveled farther and wider than we ever really give them credit for, even disallowing, say, an Atlantean continent or a Lemurian continent, just talking about what we know about. I mean, how else can the Celtic languages actually be rooted in Sanskrit? How does that happen?
Yeah, the Indo-European spread has brought with it quite a bit of culture. So one thing people overlook when they say, well, okay, where have these Indo-European languages of, like European, obviously, with Germanic, and English is part of that, and the Greek and the Latin, and then they have very pronounced similarities to Sanskrit, which in turn is derived in part from Vedic, it's an ancient Indian language. And so we know that there's this profound connection between Europe and India, and yet we're supposed to deny that any other culture came along with it. Just the language, no religion.
Yeah, only the language.
No.
That's all.
Just the language.
That's all. You know, I mean, how do we get how does the Romani culture come to worshiping a Vedic or Hindu goddess? That's
absolutely.
Really,
see that? Yeah, it's totally fascinating. I mean, if you follow the spread of the Indo-European language, and you know that they had to have brought other culture with them, not just the language. The language is reflective of what they're developing. For example, you have a cart and a horse cart, then it's named a certain term, and that culture, the cart, goes with the language, So they're not just bringing the language, they're bringing culture too, which would be the gods. There's a lot of Hinduism or ancient Indian, a vague term, but ancient Indian religion in the Russian cultural tradition as well. So, and that makes sense too, because of the proximity there. But so, and then there's also a mischaracterization of Hebrew and Egyptian cultural exchange. There's this idea that there was no influence whatsoever between the two. They're right next to each other. You could hardly miss Egypt. Egypt was in the Levant. Egypt was occupying Canaan when the Exodus supposedly happened. So how is Moses running away from the Egyptians to the Egyptians in Canaan?
Indeed, are we really not talking about ethnically the Semitic people? Embrace, the Arabic peoples of today, of course, and the Hebraic peoples of today, but they would have all been the same, essentially the same ethnic group, would they not?
Well, you have these different, according to the DNA theories, and now there are big debates about that, but you have these different groups of people who are related, certainly genetically, at some point. And the thing with the I don't know what mischaracterization, I guess, of Egypt and the Semites having no shared language is a false impression as well, because in my Moses book, which is called Did Moses Exist? The Myth of the Israelite Lawgiver, I quote one of the world's leading Egyptian language specialists, Sir Alan Gardner, and he says there's quite a bit of correspondence between Semitic and Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
And so that strange artificial line that's been built up is false. And once you remove that, you realize that there were peoples going in and out, in and out, in and out of Egypt. There were so many exoduses, it spins the head.
Yeah, indeed. So how could this have been an isolated? Well, let me ask. This is probably a burning question that everybody listening has on their brain. Do you believe that there was a historical pharaoh? Because certainly the Moses that is spoken of in the Bible, I mean, this idea that Pharaoh's daughter finds him in the bulrushes is completely inane. And, you know, I thought to myself, well, it sounds as if, you know, Pharaoh's daughter had a relationship with someone and didn't want to make it public. And the baby just appears. So this Moses, why else would the Moses of legend have been taken into the palace and allegedly,
yeah,
again, according to myth, raised by the pharaoh that most of your colleagues assume is the pharaoh of the Exodus, Ramses II? Is there any shred?
No
nothing.
No. You'll love to go through my book, because even in the photographs you get like, whoa, splash in the face. There's this, the story of, you know, the little sun god drawn from the rushes. It's basically Horus, you know, the ancient,
okay,
Egyptian sun god is drawn from the reeds. And so that tale, we also have that, of course, in Sumerian mythology with Sargon, who's drawn. I mean, I give a whole section on babies being drawn from water and what that really means in mythology.
Yeah.
And as far as the pharaoh goes, it's so. This is where, you know, the first part of the book I talk about how vague it is. I just say pharaoh, this and that. There's no denomination of this person. There's, they don't give him any name. There's no name of the daughters. There's no real time frame. It's very vague. And so once you start peeling away at that, you come to this really old layer of the tale, which is basically a battle between the sun god, or who's also a storm god, and he was also a controller of water and the sea. He was battling against the sea, the serpent of the sea, mm-hmm, the dragon of the sea, the Leviathan. There's so many different names. Tiamat. There's this whole like archetypal myth of this battle between the god and the sea dragon or demon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we find that in the earliest stratum of this mythology, for example, at Exodus 15, which is called the Song of the Sea, there's no Moses is needed in that. It's God doing these miracles, and there's the typical battle here where the pharaoh is called the dragon.
Mm.
So you have God fighting the dragon, and that is straight out of Semitic and Egyptian and Sumerian mythology. And
Celtic, too, actually, when you come right down to
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, in my chapter on the Moses, let's see, it's the Exodus as myth, I have a list of the various heroes who are fighting against the dragon of the deep or other kind of monster. We have, let me go through this list. I mean, it's not that long, but it's not comprehensive, but it gives you the idea. Apollo versus Python, Baal and Yam. Yam means sea.
Mm-hmm.
Baal means Lord. So Lord versus sea. Bel and Tamti, this is like Marduk and Tiamat. Beowulf and Grendel, Baobab and Chernobob, and Daniel and the dragon, Dionysus and Pentheus, Enki and the dragon of Kur, Indra and Vitra, Cronus and Ophion, Marduk and Tiamat, Mithra and Ahriman, Mordecai and Haman, Moses and Pharaoh, Osiris, Horus and Seth, Perseus and Gorgon, St. George and the Dragon, St. Patrick and the Snakes, Yahweh and Leviathan, Zeus and Typhon. So there's all of this mythology that is just being reworked in germ to depict the villain as Pharaoh. And even in the Old Testament, it calls Pharaoh the dragon of the deep.
Oh.
So, So now you know why it's taking place in the water, and there's this whole emphasis on drowning, and because they're basically fighting against the dragon of the deep. In the Mediterranean, in order to understand a lot of this stuff, you have to project yourself into the place. I spent a lot of time in the Mediterranean, and it was, you know, not... They didn't have that great technology back in the day. I mean, they did have telephones and cars, but not a lot of telephones.
Yeah, but they didn't move around, and probably the first cell phones were about the size of a Buick, you know. That.
Well, it was 30-something years ago, I mean, and there are plenty of primitive places where everything's still made out of wood. And wooden boats. I mean, the locals, you know, they had some pretty good boats, but if you were on the ocean all the time. A lot of them couldn't swim in Greece. It was very interesting. But we had the Phoenicians, who were just amazing sailors and seagoers, seafarers.
Yes, yes.
But they would tell stories, of course, of this monstrous sea. I mean, if you go out onto it and it's stormy and it's dark and it's frightening, you know, and you're going to be swallowed up. And so this was their big focus, was the dragons of the deep, the sea itself, but then there were monsters within the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like the core germ of this tale. And then it becomes embellished over the centuries. And eventually, the creators of the Moses myth throw in different archetypes, like Gilgamesh features in this story very, very abundantly. I have dozens of comparisons between Moses and Gilgamesh. And then in the first millennium also is Dionysus, the Greek wine god, huge comparisons between Moses and Dionysus. Dionysus crosses the Red Sea. He's driven into the water by a tyrant who is horribly killed. And I have a list of 40 comparisons that are parallels that are all cited from antiquity. And I included the Greek or the Hebrew or the Latin. So people can see it for themselves. I'm not making any of this up. These comparisons are important and profound. So one of them, as you know from reading the Promised Land of the Easter correspondence, is this article, is this entering into the Promised Land during the vernal equinox.
That was quite fascinating. And also you mentioned, if you could talk a little bit about also this idea of the sacred calf or the sacred animal that represents maybe Aries as the first sign of the zodiac.
Yeah, the ram and the lamb. There's a huge
ram-a-lam-a-ding-dong.
The emphasis is over the top on the ram, and you can find this also in the Dionysian mythos. And I quote an Orthodox Jewish rabbi who's saying that the entrance into the Promised Land occurs in Aries, and the sacrifice of the lamb has to do with, you know, the sign of the zodiac. That's just one aspect of it, but the grape thing is another. This hugely important plant, grapevine, viniculture, something really overlooked. That was all. When I was researching this, I was just gobsmacked over and over again by the correspondences between Judaism and the Dionysian religion.
And
I found so many bits of evidence that I've put into this book, including coins and mosaics and passages. And one thing that really strikes you is that in the Dionysus myth, you have a beginning of spring festival held in the honor of Dionysus, and he carries about a ripe bunch of grapes. And there's coins with grapes, and then on either side are grape leaves. And just so happens that one of the motifs for the state of Israel is two people carrying a bunch of grapes. And that has to do with Numbers 13:23, in which Joshua and Caleb are sent to spy on Canaan, and they come back with this enormous bunch of grapes. And this is straight out of Dionysian myth. We know that there's no evidence of any kind of conquest by a guy named Joshua. And oddly enough, one of Dionysus's main companions was named with a dog, and Caleb means dog, and he was one of Moses's main companions. And as it turns out, so what are we looking at? We see that Moses leaves the desolate Egypt, which has been completely destroyed through all the plagues and everything.
Yes.
Which I show to be utterly ludicrous as history.
Yes.
But then he goes into a desert. So he leaves desolation, moves into desert. So you have this kind of winter desolate thing going on here. And then he spends 40 years wandering about, terrorizing his fellow cultists into place. You know, it's a really horrible story.
You have to wonder now, how long a period of time, Archaya, are we talking about between, say, the real, you know, say where this Moses myth really had the grease on the wheels and started moving into the Hebraic traditions? How long a period of time was that from, say, you know, just arbitrarily, like the reign of Ramses II? Are we talking 100 years or 200 years before this?
It's much, yeah, but Ramses II would have been largely forgotten, except for the fact that his city was moved, and so so they had monuments about that. But you're talking up to 1,000 years after that. It was the 13th century, and there's some evidence that the Moses tale didn't even have traction among Jewish communities in the 5th century.
Wow.
With the Elephantine papyri of their Jewish Aramaic writings, and they have no idea of any Moses.
Isn't that something?
You don't see this figure burst into the scene, onto the scene, until after the 4th century.
Oh, wow.
Century, 1st century. All of a sudden in the 2nd and 1st century, and then, you know, into the 1st century, the Common Era, 2nd and 1st century B.C., all of a sudden Greeks are writing commentary on Moses. They're like, who's this guy? He's similar to... And then they themselves make this whole list of parallels between ancient lawgivers and Moses. So this is 2,000 years ago. But prior to that, there's not even... Even in the what are called the pre-exilic writings, that means before the Babylonian exile of the 6th century, so the judges, the Old Testament books that were supposedly written before then, there's almost no mention of Moses in those texts. What is mentioned seems to be interpolation, it seems out of place. So up to that point, there's really no record of this story. You find probably these old germ layers of like the Song of the Sea where Pharaoh and God are fighting, but Moses is tacked on to the beginning of that passage, Exodus 15. Exodus 15, 1a, it's called. Other than that, he's not even in that Song of the Sea, which is really the core of the Exodus tale. So he's kind of like tacked on. But what I do show in the significant latter half of my book is that he seems to be a mythical figure compiled from various characters who went by names like Mush, Mash, Mashu, Masha, including an ancient serpent god. And that would explain why there's all this focus on Moses controlling serpents and frightening snakes and turning them turning his staff into a snake. He's a
all
serpent
the time.
God.
Well, he's often. I saw some very strange frescoes in Mexico, where some almost primitive art. But yet they were picturing Moses, who really was being represented more like a Poseidon figure. Now, how Poseidon makes his way into Mexico, I'm not altogether sure, but the characters were clearly supposed to be representatives of Moses, and he had a kind of a, maybe a primitive caduceus, but probably more like a trident.
Well, I did a lot of research. I was in Mexico a couple of years ago for the December 21st, 2012.
Oh, yep, the big deal.
I was at Chichen Itza that day, so it was quite impressive.
Oh, wow.
But there are a lot of correspondences between the Old and New World mythologies, and I've gone into a huge amount of detail on that. Some of them, a very small amount of them, could have been taken with people as they traveled, like the mm-hmm. sacred mountain point of origin, a sacred tree, you know, tree of life mm-hmm. concept.
Oh,
these
yeah.
are things that would strike you no matter where you are. Mountains were either found or they were built. If there was no mountain around, they would build one. That would be a pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why you have pyramid building all over the place, because this is a really old concept that people believed there was a point of origin for their interpretation of humanity, which would be their tribe, and that it was a mountain. And from the mountain, of course, on the mountain, the laws were given by the great God. And so they would take this idea with them. There was always a mountain that they wanted to point to, and if they couldn't have
yeah.
one, if there wasn't one nearby, they would build one.
They'd
so you
make
have,
one.
Like in you know, the Nile region and the Mesoamerican areas are similar in that they're very flat. And if
mm-hmm.
you go to the Yucatan, there's almost
oh, yeah.
just little bitty hills everywhere, and they would
yeah.
build up the hills.
Flat
otherwise,
and dependent
no
on a lot of seasonal flooding that can just ruin everything, right? Just
yeah.
like the Nile Valley. That's a very big commonality. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and also they if you know when it's very lush and the greenery is growing before it's been cut down and you know turned into lime so that they could plaster the buildings, because that really caused a drought and the whole nine
yeah.
yards. But they you cannot see through those forests. They are so thick and so
yeah.
You know non-hilly. I mean that you cannot climb to a high point. So you get the impression that these were an attempt to get out of the jungle. Let's build a pyramid.
Yeah.
But,
oh, no kidding.
You know,
I've been very selfish. I've been yammering away in delight here chatting with you. We have a bunch of people on the phone here.
Oh,
so let me pick up a couple of phone calls and see what's doing here. Good evening. You are live on Contact. Hello.
Good evening. It's Wes Roberts calling in.
Oh, Wes, how are you doing? Achaya, this is Wes Roberts. He's actually the producer of our show, and he's in a remote location tonight, so he's calling in.
Okay. Hi.
Hi, and welcome. I want to tell you it's delightful to listen to you. I've been making some notes. I'm taking some time out from marking exams, so it's doubly exciting for me.
Thanks.
Oh, absolutely. I did want to jump in and ask a question, and then, of course, like you just did, Leslie, welcome other callers to call in. I see a couple of calls on the board. I was just curious to ask you a question about the way these myths tended to make things anthropomorphic. Instead of ideas, they made things into people. Was that a
mm-hmm.
common feature?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why we find so many gods and goddesses all over the place. I think that if you can go back to times before there was writing and when life was kind of tenuous and short and people were trying to pass along information to their next generation so they wouldn't lose everything that they knew, they would make up stories, they would personify the elements in order to teach children. So that would be the first and simplest thing. Also, I think they enjoyed, if you weren't raised to believe that everything is just mechanical and, you know, that the sun is just a ball of gas, and if you were raised to believe that the sun has personality and that the trees, there's some sort of spirit to them, and you won't have as difficult a time conceptualizing why everything was personified. That's a kind of a natural tendency. When you're out in nature, things do seem like they have their own personality often. You know, you'd be
mm-hmm.
sitting there, you're like, what was that? You get a chill down your spine. What the heck was that in the bushes? Or there seems to be something to it. And so everybody, if you go to India and you could see this everywhere, in ancient Indian mythology, everything is personified. And same thing with the Egyptian. Everything is personified. They have ascribe great wisdom to natural forces, like even animals, crocodiles, ibis. They see that ibis is very smart. How did the ibis? How did the god of writing, Thoth, become ibis-headed? Well, apparently they watched the ibis scratching in the ground, leaving marks with its long feet, and that looked like writing to them. You see how that works? And so they're thinking the ibis is very clever. The ibis knows how to write, and so they tell a story. Then their god has an ibis head, and this is, it starts to make sense. It's not as kooky and crazy as it looks from the outside. when it has the meaning of the myth attached to it.
So, Archaya, would you say that you are of the opinion at this point in your scholarship and your research that, say, the work of Zechariah Sitchin, where he was, you know, translating the cylinder seals in ancient Sumerian, that, in fact, you know, he had ascribed really that it would, that what he was translating were very literal events. Do you feel that the Sumerians, in fact, had an elaborate mythology, and that's, in fact, what Sitchin was translating?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's totally off base with that stuff. That's, the Anunnaki are astrotheological elements, as Enki and all these characters, they all have place within mythology. I talk about Enki, Enlil, in the Moses book as well. These are solar agencies. A lot of them have heavy sun god aspects to their story.
Indeed.
Gilgamesh, for example. And so that's what we're also looking at with Dionysus. It was very solar. The sun is considered to be the grower of grain and foliage and bringing light to the world and healing and so forth. So if you start with knowing that, how much the sun was revered as the greatest manifestation of divinity for several millennia, then you can see where a lot of these stories come from.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, even some of the stories could be in a cosmological events. And, you know, of course, with Enki and Enlil, you have a rivalry, a deep, bitter rivalry that almost, you know, speaks to the Cain and Abel, morphology, if you will. Do you see some, are there other connections in other astrotheological systems where they have, you have maybe the warring brothers and the dominant father and the cheating wife and the brother and sister thing and all of that?
Yes, you know, you go to the Canaanite texts in particular, which especially the Ugaritic texts that are about 13th century B.C., they are, you can see how purely mythological they are, even though they're anthropomorphized, of course, you know, like Zeus and Hera. I mean, these are turned into real people. I mean, they're anthropomorphized, they're turned into humans, but they're not stories about real people who are on Earth. Then you start reading these Canaanite texts, and you realize that they're completely aware that these are myths, and yet they're tied into their culture, just like the Egyptian mythology.
Yeah.
Very tied into their culture. You can see where a lot of these stories come from and what they mean, and it's becoming much more, the path is becoming much clearer now.
Yes, I would imagine so.
The one thing I wanted to emphasize about this, and then we should take some calls, I think, that the story of Moses entering into the Promised Land. He comes right up to the edge of the Promised Land after spending 40 years, and there's all these miracles keeping him alive. He's like, you know, 80 years old when he leaves, so he's 120, but all of a sudden he expires. And, you know, it makes no sense. Like, why all of a sudden do you expire as you're about to set foot in the Promised Land? And then Joshua takes over from there, and he enters in, and, you know, then the Promised Land is all, I mean, there's a big fight over it, obviously. But what is very striking, then, is that these are two, speaking of the warring brothers, there in the sun god mythology, there's often two halves of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And most frequently I've found that they go from solstice to solstice. So you have... Mm-hmm. half of the year from the summer to the winter solstice, and you have the winter solstice to the summer solstice. And those two halves of the year are personified. They're personified in Egyptian mythology. They're personified in Indian mythology. And in this case, interestingly, possibly because of the location, I don't know, I'd have to think about it more carefully, but the equinoxes become more important in certain cultures, like in closer to the the equator. But in this case, with Moses and Joshua, it looks like Moses is a solar hero going from the autumnal equinox to the vernal equinox, and then he stops, and then Joshua takes over. Joshua, of course, is the same name as Jesus, by the way.
Yes, there's no coincidence there, right?
No, there's a whole big Joshua mythology, too. But so Joshua takes over from the vernal equinox to the fall equinox. And the fall equinox is also really important in Judaism because that used to be, and that still is, the new year. But the ecclesiastical new year was switched in the Mosaic story to the vernal equinox.
Yeah.
But the autumnal equinox was the new year because of the vintage. See, wine was so important, the Feast of the Tabernacles. It's all about the vintage, the harvesting of the grapes, turning it into wine. And they would put the wine in clay containers under the earth until the spring. So the new wine goes in, and then in the spring, the god of wine is resurrected out of the ground, out of the underworld.
Yes. That makes much sense. It does, and it's even it's Celtic New Year, October 31st. That is following the same tradition, and then in Ireland on May 1st is of course Beltane, which is a huge sort of pagan fertility, everything that you're talking about, where I think in ancient times people ran around with, ram's heads on their, wearing ram's heads and God knows what else. So there you go. Anyway, we've got some of your fans are on the line here. They've been so patient. Let me just grab a few calls here. Good evening. You are live on Contact.
Hello?
You're live on Contact this evening. Did you have a question for Achaya S? Okay, I don't know what's going on there, but let me just pick up this other call here. Good evening. You are live on Contact.
Hello there. Is that me that you're talking to?
That is you. You're on the air with Leslie Mitchell Clark. This is Contact, and we've got our wonderful guest this evening, Achaya S., who's talking about the great Moses myth and her new book. And what's your name, sir?
My name is John.
Hey, John.
Okay, did you?
I knew it was you. That's
did
my buddy
you have
John.
Did you have a question or a comment or for this evening's
show?
Well,
I wanted to just compliment the new book, the Moses book, and I also wanted to compliment the great article, Moses, the Promised Land in Easter. Mm-hmm. So the article's terrific. And I guess I could throw in my question. Maybe Acharya could expand on the whole concept revolving around the number 12. Which he mentions in that article, all about the, where do I have it here, the spies that enter Israel.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe she could talk a little bit about that.
Israel. Yeah, well, you probably know. Oh, by the way, for people who are listening, Acharya is my pen name I used to write under. Now I write mostly under D.M. Murdoch, but people still call me that, which is fine. The 12 spies entering the Promised Land, yes. As John probably knows from my other writings, this motif of the 12 often, not always, often has to do with the signs of the zodiac. And so in this article and elsewhere, I've talked about that this motif is quite common. There's huge lists of the 12 tribes. There's 12... houses of light in other mythologies. There's just a tremendous list of this, and they have to do significantly with the signs of the zodiac. In older mythology, like the Egyptian, they would have to do with the hours of night and day, so 12 hours of night, 12 hours of day. But in the first millennium BC, it all started to be switched over to the signs of the zodiac. And even in antiquity, the Jewish writers Philo and Josephus compared the 12 tribes to the signs of the zodiac. And so in this case, you have the 12 signs of the zodiac entering the promised land, which is spring. And again, there we have a solar astrotheological myth with that motif as well.
Wow.
Twelve apostles is a significant one, too.
Yeah, when you move into Christianity, they've taken these motifs wholesale and just rewritten them. So it's a continual process. So once you dissect the backstory, you can start seeing where that one comes from as well. I've done an extensive amount of research on that.
Archaya, not to change the focus and stay on the line, John, not to focus take the focus away from the Moses issue that we're discussing, but I happened to be watching a rather fascinating archaeological show last week where they were the archaeologists involved believed that they had discovered an ostuary, rather, that was in fact the tomb of the biblical Jesus's family, including the biblical Jesus himself. And
right.
Again, these are ostuaries, you know, they're bones, you
right.
know, in small
yeah.
casks, and many of these casks were very ornately decorated. The individuals believed that Saint Joseph of Arimathea was buried in there. Don't know why, and also that there were essentially three languages on all of these small crypts. There was, as you mentioned before, Greek, Hebrew, and Egyptian, and some very early Christian symbology. In fact, more of the it wasn't represented with the cross, but perhaps the large fish from the Daniel mythology.
That's been refuted. I've written about that. Other people have written about that. It's all smoke and mirrors when you look at it very in depth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the names were extremely common at the time. This is what's his name? Jakubovich.
Oh, Simka.
Yeah.
Yes, the guy with the little cap and the TV show. Yeah.
Yeah, it's it's quite deceptive when you look more closely at it. It's kind of like the so-called evidence of. Yeah, James Tabor and Simcha Jakubovici.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the supposed evidence of a historical Jesus of Nazareth in Suetonius, Tacitus, Pliny, and so forth. When you look more closely at it, it's nothing of the sort. And so that is a whole other subject. I've actually written about that, the Jesus discovery in Jerusalem.
Ah. Okay, I'm always amazed by how people need a physicalization of why that concrete third dimensional, you know, that bone and that DNA is so essential, and the pursuit of it, you know, really a lot of times just defies scholarship and what we know. Even now, you probably you have more information on this certainly than I do, but I've been reading some material recently that where even the act of crucifixion as practiced by the Romans was not the, you know, the shape we were talking about earlier, dividing the.
Fine.
It was not that. It was more of an X, as in the letter X. So even this idea of crucifixion,
or even a flat T. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't apparently like that. I mean, where would they have gotten all of those trees? Where would they have gotten these huge trees where they could have built all these large, you know, edifices 8 feet up? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense.
Well,
they didn't have the trees.
They took the trees of Lebanon, the great cedars, instead of building ships, they just decided to make them into crosses.
Right.
Well, when you know the history, even you know the history of the cross that dates back thousands of years prior to the Common Era, and you also know that this story is of Moses lifting his arms in a cross shape in order to defeat the Amalekites, and he lifts up the serpent and puts the serpent on his cross, on his as a symbol of his cult. So, you know, there he is, the serpent god. And that Jesus is based on that serpent, and the shape is, you know, I mean, it's obvious, just is more myth-making. And they threw in the Romans for, you know, time period piece stuff. But, I mean, that's a whole other field, too. I've written about the cross quite extensively. My forum, Free Thought Nation forum, has freethoughtnation.com, has a significant amount of data on gods in cruciform. And that, of course, that ties in again, as I say, to the Moses story, because the early Christians thought that Moses was making the sign of the cross, and it was by the power of the cross that he was able to defeat his enemies, and they then claimed that that was foreshadowing Jesus, and so forth and so on.
Indeed.
But before we have to run, we have any more callers? Because I did promise that some people would be able to call in. I also
Let's see. I think we've got everybody right now so far. We did a few people didn't hang on too long and let go. But, folks, we have four more minutes if you'd like to call in and with Archaya S. D.M. Murdoch about her wonderful latest book, Exploring the Moses Myth, the Myth of the Israelite Lawgiver. Please do call in. We have a few more moments, and you can call in toll-free from the States at 888-891-3884. And everywhere else, you may call in to 424-220-1861. And Archaya, maybe you could let the folks know out there the best way to interface with you and also to get your book and also your wonderful calendars, of which someone gifted me one last year. So,
oh, neat. Yeah. Well, stellarhousepublishing.com is my publishing website, and it's got all my goodies there. I've got ebooks as well on Jesus as the Son, my new Moses book. The astrotheology calendars are there. There's a great images of archaeological sites and mythological paintings and mosaics and so forth. And when I tell you the history of them and I tie them in to show how humanity has been very engaged in nature worship and significantly as well, the celestial bodies, sun, moon, stars, and so forth and so on. And we can see this in biblical story after biblical story. The Ezekiel tale, I go into some detail about that too. The wheel within the wheel and the four living creatures. And that also is in the Moses book. I have a whole chapter on Yahweh as the sun god. And so when Yahweh, in that chapter, I speak about Ezekiel and how that's the zodiac again, and the four fixed signs are the four faces of the creature that he sees. And the sun is riding in the chariot, the Merkaba.
Yes.
When it's not personified, this information to me is actually more powerful and fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
When
it is.
I mean, it can be personified in that we can think of these things as having personality. I'm not totally against it. It isn't, you know, it's a mythological construct, but not as real people who walked around on Earth, as natural forces, as, like I say, the sun god or the moon, or there's a lot of moon mythology, too. Of course, with Judaism is significantly lunar.
Right. It's a lunar calendar, is it not, the Judaic or Hebraic calendar?
Yes. They also, of course, used solar calendars. We found one at the Dead Sea, but there are many elements of Judaism that are also solar. I mean, you can't really avoid the sun.
Indeed, indeed. There's, you know, there's just so much more that binds us together than keeps us separate. When you really talk about the nitty gritty and the nature worship implications of so many of these things, you know, I feel like we have just scratched the surface, Archaya, and I would love for you to come back in the very near future and speak some more about Moses and also some of your other, I'd love to explore the Horus connection and some of these other marvelous topics that you have written about in your wonderful career. So thank you so much, I screwed up your name at the last moment. D.M. Murdoch, a wonderful author, archaeologist, and thank you so much for joining us on Contact this evening.